The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Welcome back to another Mission Minded. Keep your mind, your mission on your mind. That was the problem. We didn't start the show talking about Mission Minded. Keep your mind, your mission on your mind. It threw us off a little bit. I'm Tony Curry. He's Michael Coleman, the CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. Big news this week. The government is back. I heard that several states, it's interesting because it seems like the government wants the states to do everything. And then when the states try to do what they want to do, then the government says, don't do that. So at least in California, I know some people got their cards loaded up. Then I heard something in the state of Alabama. If you haven't had your card loaded up by the end of the day, you'll have it by Monday or something like that. Explain to people how hopefully we don't need to know how it works, because that means we're not using the SNAP program. But how does the SNAP program? Is it just a card? And next thing you know, is there stuff on it? How's that work?
Yeah. So you think about it almost like block grants, to where, you know, one of the things about the education department, they talk about doing away with that. What they would do is they would just send the money down instead of with all these federal requirements. They just block grant it, which is, we're going to give you $1 billion and it has to be used for education. Go. And I personally like that approach, because then what happens is you kind of have 50 different experiments across the country. So it's a lot of the same thing. Like, they have money dedicated for each state based on the number of people who qualify for SNAP against the federal income levels. And each state has some money they have to put into it.
Okay.
And so based on all of that, they actually get to set the rates. Each state sets the rate. So if you go to California, SNAP is going to be much more than in Alabama, in part because the cost of living is much less. You know, all those factors play into it. But yeah, it's everybody gets a card. So imagine on your debit card, if you've got $5 in your checking account and you go to the grocery store, you know, you've got $5 worth of buying power.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with SNAP card. But once you make a deposit, then whatever you've put in there. So it's the same way, they put it into their account. It's all electronic transferred into their SNAP account. And then they're able to pull off of that as they go through the month.
What's really interesting, and I do several things with some different churches. Shepherd of the Hills is one church that I work with. They have a little food pantry. It's nothing that actually works through Feeding America. They just do it for their, it's basically a store. It's down the bottom of their church, and they invite people to come in and grab whatever they want. And they just do it. It works for them. But she's like, Pastor Kristen, who I was talking to, she's like, we have just been indulged with so much food over the last week and a half, because sometimes it takes a tragedy. It takes an absolute tragedy for people to realize just what is needed in this country and who needs it. So people are really ponying up. Unfortunately, we have to have a 9/11 to start taking care of each other once in a while. And this has been certainly one of the situations. Have you seen that with the Heart of Alabama Food Bank?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I may have even said this last week, you know, there's an old adage in the nonprofit world, you know, you never let a crisis go by without utilizing it. And that sounds manipulative, but the truth of the matter is, it's like I said about, you know, we do disaster relief. I have tried to put disaster relief in my budget and fundraise for disaster relief. Can't get a dime. People don't want to give towards what may happen at some point down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the disaster happens, that's when you have to take advantage of it. People go, well, doesn't that feel like that you're exploiting a situation? And we're like, yeah, it does feel that way. And sometimes, I'll be honest with you, that it kind of feels kind of yucky. But where I'm talking about SNAP, but the bottom line is, that's when we need people, because here's what we know about in food banking, and it's relative to any sort of disaster or crisis. We're already starting to see it. When they saw the government start to come back together, a lot of our donations that we were getting, I mean, we were getting calls every day, people walking in, writing huge checks, first-time donors, wow, all of that. Well, that was already, as soon as you start saying, oh, they're voting, they're going to turn SNAP back on in a day or two, then those donations started coming down, both in size and in quantity. And that's just human nature. Sure. Once the crisis starts to go away, people don't feel as compelled to give. Well, what we see from the food banking perspective is, you know, and it's not just through the holidays, January is going to roll around, kids are going to go back to school. But the crisis with food insecurity and all of that is still going to be there. Yet people are going to, you know, we get the giving season and everybody's going to be like, oh, I've got credit card bills to pay to, you know, pay for Christmas. I've got the rest of the year and just on and on and on. And people go back to their lives. And that is just human nature. So it's very tough. I mean, I anticipate our fundraising is going to be low in January and February and March. So, yeah, you know, and I'm very honest about it up front. I'm like, look, it's not just this crisis. We've got to feed people in January, but people don't want to hear that message. You can't live in crisis because eventually people turn a deaf ear to you.
Yeah. So my understanding is they're voting to have the government and everything opened up through the end of January, but SNAP's been extended through the end of September of next year. Is that correct? Or is that how far has SNAP been extended then?
To be honest with you, I've been so busy in the food banking world. I haven't on the legislation. I do know that it was extended to the end of January. I haven't heard, or I'm not sure of the details of any sort of special allocation in there, but they certainly could have done that.
Don't stop giving. I mean, just assume that that will end in January, because we're going to be right back in the same damn boat coming up here in just 78 days.
If they don't get the normal bills passed, and that's what it's for. It's not just to kick the can down the road. The Republicans have passed three funding bills. They have, I think there's a total of 11 that they have to do. One's the farm bill, as I've been talking about for a year and a half, mm-hmm. that, you know, has to be passed, supposed to be passed every 5 years. We're going into year 8. So the idea is the government is going to extend all that out to give them time to do the normal appropriation process. And so what's going to happen is by the end of January, they're going to, or as it's coming up on January, they're going to see how far they've gotten in that process. And, or, you know, they may ask for another short-term extension as they're going through. Because you got to understand, and I don't even know, it's hard for me to know off the top of my head to go back and pinpoint it, but they are required by law every year to create a budget, and Congress has to allocate the spending for the government. Okay. So all that has to be approved. Well, years and years and years ago, there was when it started fighting and squabbling over that, what they started with, okay, we're going to do these continuing resolutions. The problem with the continuing resolution, you know, a lot of people have probably heard about this. It was a clean CR versus not a clean CR. Mm-hmm. And first of all, let me say up front, and the roles were reversed in the past. So Democrats were, when they were in charge, they were like, oh, we're just asking for a clean CR passage. And Republicans were making certain demands. But then, you know, Republicans were called terrorists back then for holding the budget process up. And mm-hmm. it's just amazing how it's all. But having said that, a clean CR is basically this. It's a continuing resolution to fund the government at its current level. So you're not adding to it. You're not cutting it. There's nobody sneaking in. Oh, I want $1 billion for a bridge back home in my district.
Yeah.
But so that's a clean CR. Lots of times there's been CRs where everybody's fighting for, oh, well, this is where I can just stick in a bunch of, you know, and both sides are getting pork to take back home.
Sure.
So that's been going on. And what happened is they just kicked the can down the road rather than having to do the tough work of actually creating a budget that can be looked at from year to year to say, did you stay within budget, not stay within budget? Because the finances get so crazy under these CRs. these continuing resolutions. And when that goes on for years and years and years, and you're not actually passing a budget that can be analyzed, that can be evaluated by the Congressional Budget Office, and all of those to anticipate the effects of this budget, how much it's going to add to the deficit, how it's going to affect growth, on and on and on, all those things.
It's kind of crazy.
It's just one more. And it's just a lack of discipline and a lack of doing what our government officials. And like I said, there's plenty of examples on both sides of the aisle to show that this has been a problem. Now, this latest episode, it is falls more on the Democrats. And I know this wasn't really the topic, but when you talk about giving and you talk about support of need, when you talk, what they wanted was an extension for 1 year of subsidies for Obamacare. And then remember, go back to Obamacare. He spent the first 2 years of his presidency with Obamacare. It was signature legislation. And you go back and he's saying, we are going to reduce health care up to $25,000 per family. Mm-hmm. Well, Obamacare has nearly tripled in cost in, 10 years. Now, what they did was when the Democrats were in charge under Biden, and I think this was in 21, they had the first subsidies that came out. Well, guess what? With the rising cost of health care to make Americans not feel the pinch, they increased the subsidies. And so what they've done, the only way you can make Obamacare work is they took young Americans and made them pay a higher health, forced them to get health insurance. As you know, they have to claim it on your taxes.
Yeah.
But they had to charge them for a higher rate to be able to pay for the people who are using all the health care, which are older people.
Yeah.
And so there's all sorts of problems. Just structurally speaking, it's not a good program. What's going to continue to happen as it continues to climb, either people are going to drop out or we're going to have to continue to subsidize it. And which means you're taking more and more taxpayers and basically giving it to insurance companies. Well,
and that's the part that bothers me.
Structurally flawed.
That's the part that bothers me most, because I'm in that boat. I'm self-employed. I don't have someone paying my health insurance. And I, along with 40 million other people that are in that situation, whether you're older, you're self-employed, you have your own business. It was, for us, it's great. I mean, super. Yeah. I mean, I went 3 years.
It's just not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. And I realize that. I mean, at some point you're going to have to rip the Band-Aid off. And I went 3 years with no health care. I've got three kids I had to take care of. And so, I'm thinking to myself, okay, God, please don't give me cancer or anything for 3 years. And I didn't want to do that. But then here I am in this situation again where they offered it. I've got it. Now all of a sudden it feels like it's going to be taken away from me again. I'll figure it out. I'll just stay at home and Lysol.
And most young people were, if they had a choice paying premiums, they'd say, look, I'm going to roll those dice. But what I think we really need, and I know it's a very, very complex issue, and what I'm about to say is an oversimplification. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to have a catastrophic health coverage. Like, so if you had something along the lines of Obamacare, where young people could say, look, if I lose a leg, if I have a leg chopped off, I'm in a major car accident, whatever, there's catastrophic care. But I'm going to pay out of pocket if I want to go to the doctor and, for flu, or if I want to go get a shot or whatever it is, or lots of times people just tough it out and they'd rather do that, but they have some choice in it. You're like, okay, I'm going to maintain this ability. But then what do you do about the ever increasing aging population who are retiring? There's more and more of that. They're living longer because we're keeping people alive longer. That has to be dealt with as well.
Yeah.
And I think the only way, and I'm not saying I have any idea how to do it, but if you just look at our market, anything the government does, you look at defense spending, everything else explodes, healthcare, anything else. The only thing that controls prices is market competition. Now, And so if you had people competing rather than saying, well, you have to get insurance. And in Alabama, they control that. There's only a couple of companies who are allowed to sell insurance.
I know, yeah.
So you don't have a true open competitive marketplace. But if you did, and you kind of freed that up where they were competing for people's business, and then in essence, you, instead of paying these huge things to insurance companies, these huge subsidies, if you could allow people to have like those medical savings accounts and shop for their insurance. And yeah. Then you open up the market and let them shop and make it competitive. I think that would just very naturally drive prices down. And then people could buy what they wanted to buy, not buy
what they need. I mean, that's the other thing I think a lot of people, and certainly I'm in the same boat, but I mean, the first thing you do is you look at the lowest coverage you can possibly get, and you know, your deductible is going to be through the roof. And then you're thinking to yourself, God forbid, I have do something where I'm going to come out of pocket $8,500. If you do it, change your life. It's the way it is. There's not going to be an easy way.
That's right.
Hey, I wanted to end, because we only got about 10 or 15 minutes, but I wanted to talk about it is the time of the year of giving. A lot of people have taken this opportunity and have found a silver lining in this whole SNAP thing. And the government shut down to help their neighbors and help their people. I didn't realize that one in eight people in this country were actually needing some assistance. I knew it was one in five kids. I heard a really interesting stat I wanted to throw your way, and I know there's no way you can prove this. I don't know where they got this number, but I heard something on a station the other day that we have enough food in this country for every human being in this country to intake 4,000 calories a day.
That's true.
And considering that 2,000 is the benchmark, we want to stay around 2,000 calories. If you want to keep your weight on, you got about 2,000 calories. The fact that every human being in the country can take on 4,000, which is just amazing to me. But we are one of the most giving states, period. We can be at the bottom of the low in a lot of different things. But, man, we are here for each other. And that's one of the things that I love. You can talk about Southern hospitality. You can call it what. So there are a lot of people out there that certainly towards the end of the year, they do want some tax breaks, as they certainly deserve. Or perhaps I know a lot of people will go through estate issues where they have an amount of money and they want to give back to the zoo, or they want to give St. Jude's.
Things
they're passionate about. Yeah. Can you talk just a little bit about that and how to do that research to know, give me some numbers? Because I know a lot of people, the first thing they like to look at, and I got a friend of mine who's a philanthropic, and he's all about the numbers. He wants to know what the percentage. So he can call the March of Dimes or the Heart of Alabama Food Bank or whatever, and he knows to the penny, okay, what percentage of my money is actually going towards what you need this money for? Let's start there. Is that a good way to start?
Yeah, and I will tell you, if you I subscribe to the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and that's very helpful on some levels. But for years and years and years, the gold standard was people would say, what's your administrative cost? Mm-hmm. And what that meant was, so you have administrative cost, which are the costs that are necessary to run your organization, but are not directly tied to programs. So it would be, in essence, all your overhead, that's maybe not necessary. Any staff salaries that were not program related, or any fundraising costs that your organization and the goal was, you want them to have as low as possible, but certainly not anything over 20%. You know, you need to have something lower than that. And about 5 years ago, that trend really started changing because lots of times wealthy people who were giving said, you know, when you look at this, that is a determination, but it really doesn't tell you the impact that somebody's making. What it leads you to believe is, oh, they're using their money more productively towards the programming. Let's say if my admin costs were 10%, mm-hmm. okay? But that's not real to me. That's really not the question. The question is what you should be looking at is what impact an organization is making. So, for instance, I could have a 10% admin cost And but my programming itself, even though all the money's going towards work, the programs itself either aren't effectively addressing the problem that they're supposed to be, or that there could be waste even inside the program, or maybe the problem that you're spending so much money on is really not a core passion or a core problem to you. So there's lots of things to go to. So I think a more sound approach, instead of trying to splice dollars away. So let's take the opposite. Let's say you go in somebody's 30% admin. Okay. And you're like, oh, that's crazy. But maybe they have to have.
And when you say, real quick, when you say 30% admin, that means 30% of every dollar coming in is used for administrative cost.
That's right. Okay. When you take their total budget and it's all broken, and we have to do this on our audit.
Yeah.
I mean, we're down below 5%.
Yeah.
But, and that's in part the cost of the food, everything else. But let's say you reverse that. Let's say somebody's 30% and, but you look at it and you go, wow, this program is life-changing, and the impact they're making, and they do it so well. So what that change has kind of been, and there's been people who've been slow to come around to it. I get it. Some people still hold to that, like your friend about the admin costs. Mm-hmm. The question is, what as a donor, what am I passionate about? And then I look around and go, okay, who is making the most impact on that problem? And so that's, it doesn't mean you throw the admin issue out the door, but don't let that solely be the governing determination. It should be who's affecting this issue in society, impacting most people who are hurting or so on. Now, there's all sorts of organizations out there. Charity Navigator is one. There are others that you can reach out to, and you can do a search for the nonprofit that you're interested in. If you just want to do some basic research.
It's called Charity Navigator?
Charity Navigator is one. There's others.
Yep.
And what it'll do is, it will tell you the transparency rate. So what one is, and I get some of them mixed up, but typically it's something like you have a bronze or no rating, and then you have a bronze, you have a silver, you have a gold, and you have a platinum rating. So every year, nonprofits like myself have to do a 990 form, which accounts for all of that. You have to do an audit. You have to do all these things. Mm-hmm. Larger nonprofits, not every nonprofit has to do an audit every year, but we certainly do. So if somebody looks us up, we need to have to be platinum, we have to have all our records updated. We have to have all the information, our mission, our budget, every document they ask for, you have to have it. But the idea is, well, here's full of transparency, and that's what they're really after. You'll have some nonprofits on there that just aren't good about, it's not that they are trying to hide themselves. They're just not doing a good job of keeping those websites updated in terms of their own information. And then some people don't want you to know, you know, and so they try to keep that information pretty close to the vest, and share that information.
How important is it that I can speak from experience, because I had a foundation that was a 501c3 with my wife. It was the two of us, 100% everything we did went out. We did over probably $500,000 for special needs individuals through Ark of Jefferson and Walker Counties and blah, 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 blah. We did that for almost 10 years. Unfortunately, it divorce kind of broke that apart. But we didn't have a board. It was something we always know we needed to have. We were always $50,000 or $50 or under. So we weren't really, but we were making an impact wherever we went, but we weren't a multi-million dollar. We realized the bigger we got, and if we got any bigger than $50,000, we were certainly going to do that. Can you talk a little bit about the board process and how important that is?
Yeah, well, it's very important. I'll give you a good example. I will tell you now, I don't know what it was years ago. Before I learned all this, you are required to, by the IRS, if you are a 501c3, and you are to a charitable donation where people can take that off their taxes, you're required to have a board with a minimum of three individuals. Now, where you run into some like very small nonprofits, they could be pantries, they could be whatever they are, little community things, that lots of times what I've seen is you look on their board and everybody on their board's in their family.
Yeah.
So what boards do, boards are the one legally who are responsible for ensuring, for the oversight of the board to ensure. So there's actually financial culpability with a board member. If you're not doing oversight like you should, let's say a board never does a budget or never works with a director to do the budget, doesn't do an audit, doesn't even pay attention to the finances, and there's theft from, no, they can be personally held accountable to reimburse that. So there are real legal ramifications about that kind of thing. And so a board is supposed to be independent and is supposed to be so that they can hold the parties accountable and you can have confidence. I would never give to me personally being in it. I would never give to a nonprofit who was made up of somebody's board. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an example. Every board is supposed to have a conflict of interest statement, every board member. So it's okay to have a conflict of interest. I'll give you a good example. Even before this person, we have Baxter Technologies. Well, Craig Baxter, I signed a contract to have them because I thought it was best for the food banking network. So, and they do all IT management and mm-hmm. all that. Well, a year later, they asked my board asked Craig to come be on the board. Well, that's a conflict of interest because we're doing business with Craig. Now, it's not illegal, but what's always a good idea is every year, anything that matches like that, or you're doing any business together, you should do a conflict of interest statement. And the conflict of interest statement is sent out to all the board members. And it's actually put in the business, in the minutes of the business meeting, of the board meeting, and that all of them have been stating that it was made public and everybody's aware.
Yeah.
And so that is what is transparency is all about, and accountability. They're like, yes, I get it. There's a conflict here, but everybody's aware of it. These aren't two guys that are hiding this conflict and doing some backdoor deal. The entire board knows about it. We've explained why that conflict exists, and we're moving forward in full acknowledgement.
It can certainly work. I mean,
that's why it's so important to identify those things. So when you pull a 990, it will have every board. It'll have the key staff members of a nonprofit, the ones that are making the highest amount of money. So usually it's just the CEO, but it'll have every board member listed. I would encourage you to go look at it. I would encourage you to, I will tell you, lots of small nonprofits sometimes, and I think there's a lot of deceit in this. If you make less than $50,000 in a year, you can do what's called a 990N, which is almost like a postcard. Now, we have to hire attorneys to do 990s because it's very involved. But a 990N is just a postcard, and they send it off, and it looks like, oh, I'm up to date with IRS because I've done my stuff. But since that doesn't have to be audited, I know of nonprofits that are bringing in over $50,000, but they're still sending that in. And all of that is a sign of a lack of transparency. So if you're unfamiliar with an organization and they get something in the mail and you feel like sending them money, it's always good. You can find out about them on their website. You can, and these charity navigators, these other sites that track all of that. You can also go to the IRS and just type in IRS nonprofit search. It'll take you to a search tab. So every nonprofit that is currently in good standing with the IRS will come up if you type the name in. You do it by EIN or name. So you can check there. And if it's been discontinued, it will tell you that. Like if it was discontinued and then brought back. So it kind of gives you a history. There's all sorts of tools online now to let you know whether somebody's legitimate or not. But nothing replaces actually going there and watching them firsthand do what they do. Anybody says, hey, Michael, I want to be a donor, but I want you to give me a tour. I want to see how your programming works. I've got a lot of questions and I make myself totally available. And, you know,
been there, done that, man. Listen, we've been in partnership together. And the first thing I wanted to do is come down and see. And I was blown away by, and I'm not just saying that because you're my friend and you're on Tony Kerr Radio, but the way you run your organization, we've broken bread with other board members. It's just amazing what you do down there. And of course, they're covering 35 counties and it's important. It's super important. And I mean, particularly for someone that, you know, like if you're doing something like special needs or something like that, that's great. And obviously we can't care for everybody, but when you're talking about something as basic as feeding people, you have to be efficient. I mean, you have to be super, super, super efficient because every dime that doesn't go through is not going down throwing someone's throat. So, I mean, it's important.
And let me just say this. I don't want to scare people, but let me tell you something. There's a lot of people who have gone to the trouble of actually getting to get a legitimate 501c3 designation, but are using it to pad their pockets. Mm-hmm. Be very mindful who you give to. And that you're not perpetuating somebody. So, doing harm to the community, because that's exactly what it is. I will tell you, one of the things that we have sometimes is we have found that people who are supposed to be helping us distribute the food are sometimes charging the people. And who are they charging? They're charging poor seniors. They're charging people who can't put food on the table. They're charging desperate people. And, you know, you call it a side hustle, you call it street rules, you call it whatever you want to. The bottom line is I've taken a very tough stand on that because the people that they, it's not a victimless crime because they're just doing using the food to get a little side hustle. They are taking advantage of the poor and seniors and oftentimes people who both intellectually and otherwise don't know the difference. Yeah. And I despise that. And I'm fighting this. Everybody do your homework. There's lots of stuff out there. Give to those who are doing a great impact because the nonprofit world is standing in many gaps in our society doing the work that the government can't and our private citizenry can't do it. So support your local nonprofit, whatever your passionate and your issues are.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Kerr Radio.